Hello again. It's really great to be with you all here and to see some familiar faces from years ago. I was here probably last about 10 or 12 years ago, and so it's been a minute, but it's great to be back, and I'm grateful to Tim for this invitation and to share this beautiful morning with you all on these ancestral lands of our Chumash neighbors and friends. Tim and I agreed that part of what I would talk about this morning would be to kind of honor the memory of Joanna Macy, who some may be familiar to some of you. She died last year and was kind of a towering figure in the environmental movement more broadly, but I think just also among people who really are looking to kind of reintegrate and reconnect with their own ancestral traditions, in addition to finding new ways to bring spirituality to the task of living in a new way in the moment that we live in. So I will talk a little bit about Joanna Macy. Of course, she was she died, I think, last year at the age of 97. But of course, because she was a Buddhist and an animist, she knew that she would live on in the many forms of her continuation and in the bodies and minds of those whose lives were transformed by her teachings. If there's anything that the various kinds of what we're going to call deep ecology can teach us and help us to see, it's that an individual life is an oxymoron. You want to let that sit there for a moment. An individual life is an oxymoron. It of course is a contradiction in terms. More on that in a moment. I want to start by asking you to imagine, and actually I was loving that children's book, and it was a good preparation actually for what I'm going to ask you to do. I want you to take a moment, if you want to close your eyes, and I want you to just imagine a place. Maybe it's close to here, maybe not, but a place that you feel a deep sense of connection, peace, belonging, mutuality, maybe even a sense of being known, being held. What is it like there? What other kinds of beings exist there? What kinds of interactions take place among them? How are those interactions shaped by the landforms and waterways, by the soil type and the rainfall, by the amount of day and night? In the kinds of traditions and teachings that I'm going to speak about this morning, those places are, in fact, the ground of our being. They are that which make us up. We don't exist apart from them. We, in fact, call the very world into being with our co-creators at every moment, at every instance, in every place. There is no separation. I myself call to mind the forest, or the woods, as we say in central Minnesota, where I grew up. Specifically, St. John's Abbey and University, which I had been going to since I was a very young child. I grew up right near there. Comprises about 3,000 acres of land in one of the most biodiverse and beautiful areas of that region. The ancestral home of Dakota and Ojibwe peoples. In fact, the North Fork of what's called the Watab River runs right through St. John's, or Collegeville, Minnesota, what is now called St. John's. And that was the demarcating line between the what's called the 1825 Treaty of Prairie du Chien, a U.S. government-imposed treaty, establishing Dakota land to the south of the line and Ojibwe land to the north. And that that place has been a very special place, not only for the monks and, you know, the Benedictines who came and settled in that area, but also for many people for thousands of years before that. It was there that I first had meaningful encounters with forests and lakes and deer and beavers and muskrats and salamanders and indigo buntings and frogs and mosquitoes, many, many mosquitoes, horse flies, yeah, deer flies, they're even worse. And of course, that other local species, Benedictine monks. It was there that I studied ecology as a biology major, and also, and of course, you know, as a biology major, an ecology major, learning hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of birds and plants. And I was pre-med though, so I was always kind of confused by these people who were so obsessed with, you know, learning all of these things about birds and plants. But it was there in that forest that I think I really truly first fell in love with a place. Fell deeply, and it's still, I would say, in many ways, my spiritual home. It's also the place where I really first encountered religion and learned that you could study religion in a way that was capacious and inviting and diverse and open, and that you could also study religion and ecology with each other, and that doing that would bring out all kinds of new insights and approaches and understandings. And it's actually just kind of interesting to me that one of the founding figures of the modern like religion and ecology movement, it's actually a kind of dynamic duo, Mary Evelyn Tucker and John Grimm, and John Grimm was a graduate of St. John's as well, so I can only imagine that he had some of those same kinds of experiences that I did. More recently, my love for forests has been cultivated in the Los Padres National Forest, where piñon and Jeffrey pines commingle with the oaks and many native grasses and shrubs and provide habitat for 468 fish and wildlife species. Although it's interesting, the Forest Service says on their website at least 468. And I'm like, well, is it 468 or is it more than that? Like, that's a very specific number. Like, 468 species, 77 of which are endangered, threatened, or sensitive. That's a big number. You may know that just a couple weeks ago, and someone registered that in the joys and sorrows, that the Forest Service made a series of pretty breathtaking announcements about new plans for the what they're calling a reorganization of the Forest Service, which of course is going to include the closing of research stations around the country. It includes the closing of most of the experimental forests where they were doing experiments on how to actually do forest stewardship in a way that that is sustainable and resilient in the face of climate change. The Forest Service posted this on their website. Since last July, agencies at the USDA, that is what the Forest Service is under, have shown that they can reduce environmental review timelines by up to 80%. These faster, more efficient reviews are saving the department millions in taxpayer dollars, said Secretary Rollins. Those savings benefit the American people, and quicker reviews mean the loans, critical infrastructure, and forest health projects our farmers, ranchers, and rural communities depend on can move forward sooner. USDA is proud to help advance President Trump's vision of a government that serves its citizens, beginning with cutting unnecessary bureaucratic overreach. we are living in a time where there are apparently no limits to the kinds of arrogance that our own government can demonstrate. Bill McKibben in The New Yorker just this week, a couple days ago, wrote, although there's always been pressure on the service to increase the cut and harvest more timber for local mills and builders. And although this has often led to egregious clear cutting, the service was once reputed to employ more landscape architects than any other organization in the world. There's also been a measurable move toward sounder science. And then he says, I was once told over a beer with one of the heads of the Clinton era Forest Service that its research showed unequivocally that the greatest value of those millions of acres was not timber or even recreation, but the way that intact forests absorb and filter water, which reduces both flooding and the need for expensive artificial filtration. To say nothing of what intact forests do to capture and sequester carbon and create oxygen for us to breathe. So I think we've never been more in need of the deep wisdom and the motivation inspired by the voices that we might broadly kind of call the deep ecology voices of our time. And that includes traditions such as engaged Buddhism of Thich Nhat Hanh. It includes indigenous traditions and life ways. It includes voices like Joanna Macy's. I was gonna read a little Thich Nhat Hanh, but we've already heard a little Thich Nhat Hanh today. So I might actually just kind of pass over that for now. But actually, I will. Why not? Thich Nhat Hanh. So I feel like I'm preaching to the converted a little bit here, and I probably won't really say anything that you don't already know. But I also think that it's good for us to get reminders and to get inspiration and to draw that from each other and bring voices into the conversation that that can't be in the room. And I will say also, I am not a native person. I have tried very hard over the last 15 or 20 years to put myself in conversations with people who can help me learn and understand and develop some wisdom that draws from those traditions as well. So back to Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, we inter-are. There is no being outside of the interbeing that make us all living beings. As human beings, we see that we are children of the earth and not separate from the soil, the forests, the rivers, the sky. We share the same destiny. We share the same destiny. If we try to dominate or oppress nature, it rebels. We must be deep friends with nature in order to manage certain aspects of it and create harmony with our environment. This requires a full understanding of nature. Typhoons, tornadoes, droughts, floods, volcanic eruptions, proliferation of harmful insects all constitute a danger to life. We can largely prevent the destruction that natural disasters cause by working with the land from the beginning, making plans and building decisions that take into account the nature of the land, instead of trying to impose complete control over it with dams, deforestation, and other devices and policies that in the end cause more damage. So I want to go back to this statement that that forests are for timber and bring in Robin Wall Kimmerer, who I think is probably someone that you're familiar with. I think, Tim, you said that folks had done like a reading group here of Braiding Sweetgrass. I highly recommend her newer book called The Service Berry. She actually was, as some of you may know, she was supposed to be on our campus almost exactly a year ago to give a lecture. And unfortunately, there was a big snowstorm and that was canceled at the last minute and she wasn't able to join us. But she did give a Zoom lecture, which I have to say was a very surreal kind of experience, given the fact that Kimmerer, among so many other people, have, right, the core of the teaching is embodiment, is the embodied nature of life, and a return to the ground of being. And to hear her speak through Zoom was really strange. So in any case, She says that there is no formula that's complex enough to hold the birthplace of stories. It pains me to know that an old-growth forest is worth far more as lumber than as lungs of the earth. And she writes in the service, Barry, many indigenous peoples, including my Anishinaabe relatives and my I actually have said this word so many times, and I don't know why. Haudenosaunee neighbors inherit what is known as a culture of gratitude, where lifeways are organized around recognition and responsibility for earthly gifts, both ceremonial and pragmatic. Our oldest teaching stories remind us that failure to show gratitude dishonors the gift and brings serious consequences. If the first response to the receipt of gifts is gratitude, then our second is reciprocity, to give a gift in return. And she asks, as she's thinking about this service-berry economy, as she puts it, what could I give these plants in return for their generosity? I could return the gift with a direct response, like weeding or bringing water or offering a song of thanks that sends appreciation out on the wind. I could make habitat for the solitary bees that fertilized those fruits. I'm guessing that there's probably a higher incidence of native plant gardens in this room than your average. Or maybe I could take indirect action, like donating to my local land trust. Thank you. So that more habitat for the gift givers will be saved. Speaking at a public hearing on land use, or making art that invites others into the web of reciprocity. We live in a time when every choice matters. I say that knowing that we have to also avoid the risk of thinking that individual action and individual choice in a consumer economy is going to be the thing that makes the kind of change that we need. It's not. We also need the kind of collective action that holds people accountable for the kinds of decisions that they make with the commons. That is to say, what is shared among all of us, not only as humans, but as the entire web of life. It kind of reminds me of a line, I don't know if any of you saw that film probably like a decade ago, called Race, which dramatizes the story of Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics. In that film, there's a decisive moment where Owens seems to be making some poor life decisions. And his college track coach says to him, "It won't feel like you're making choices until it's too late. It won't feel like you're making choices until it's too late." So there's this moment in the film where Owens, right, sort of suddenly realizes that his agency is real. It won't feel like you're making choices until it's too late. So I think I want to talk a little bit about Joanna Macy, as I said. I want to bring her voice into this as well. She wrote a lot. I don't know if any of you familiar with Joanna Macy? Read any of her work? Oh, great. Okay. So this is new to many of you. She was a fascinating person who lived a very fascinating life, including like working for the CIA, translating Rilke poems from the German, and then becoming a kind of iconic figure of the environmental movement. And I say that again broadly, who did a lot of deep work to translate and to kind of put in conversation with each other those deep wisdom traditions, from monotheistic to indigenous to Eastern traditions, to try to speak to the moment. And what she did was kind of diagnose this notion that the industrial growth society, right, products of which are like what's happening in the Los Padres forest now, that era is coming to an end. By definition and by necessity, that era is coming to an end. And that what is emerging and what she helped to bring into being is what she called the great turning. The great turning. And what she meant by that is the slowly but surely and great turning toward the world of life through spiritual traditions, through spiritual practice, through ritual practice, through embodiment and embodied practice, place-based practice, the emergence of what she called the ecological self. That is to say, the kind of human being that understands ourselves in relation by definition, not as a nice way to think about things, but actually as the very ground of our being. So she says that, and she called this the work that reconnects. And so this is, I'm gonna kind of like try to bring this to a close a little bit here, but I think she says that, like, if we start to think about it this way, then what we start to do is we start to see all around us those opportunities for reconnection. And I think, you know, I'm not going to recommend any particular courses of action today. I think you all, I have a sense that you all are engaged in a lot of different ways in making the world a better place. Invite you to consider how this might sort of add to or help guide those kinds of choices that you make. But the basic tenets of the work that reconnects are these. This world in which we are born and take our being is alive. Drawing on the, you know, both those indigenous traditions, but also other sort of living systems theory, like James Lovelock and others, the sort of Gaia hypothesis. It is our larger body, right? In the Buddhist tradition, there's this notion that the small self is, right, is this, and then the larger self is the world, right? Our true nature, that's the first one. Our true nature is far more ancient and encompassing than the separate self defined by habit and consumer society. Far more ancient and encompassing. The third one, and there I think she's kind of drawing on Buddhist ideas of impermanence and that those notions of dependent co-arising and things like that. The third one, our experience of pain for the world springs from our connectivity with all beings, from which also arises our power to act on their behalf. So we have to feel the pain of the destruction that we are part of in order to begin to act differently. Unblocking, she says, occurs when our pain for the world is not only acknowledged, but experienced. In other words, rituals like the kind of rituals that you do here help us experience both a personal but also a kind of collective grief. And that's a real thing. that's a very real thing, right? Climate grief, for example, is a very real thing. When we reconnect with life by choosing to bear our pain for it, the mind retrieves its natural clarity. In other words, we start to see what it is we're here for, who we are here to be. And then finally, she says, the experience of reconnection with the earth community arouses the urge to act on its behalf. And she invokes their Buddhist ideas of like bodhicitta, right? This sort of the compassion that naturally inspires action. And that can look a lot of different ways, you know? It can look a lot of different ways. It can even look like being invited into a community to say some words of other people's wisdom. So she says there's a spiral to this work. There's a spiral to this work. And I love the fact that you have a spiral here, right? that is that was the spiral that contained the joys and the sorrows. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. So she says the spiral of the work that reconnects is, number one, gratitude. It starts with gratitude. Then it goes to honoring our pain, and then seeing with new eyes, and then going forth. But it's a spiral. So that's not something that happens once, but it happens again and again and again and again as you continue in the spiral. And that the more we do that, right, the more we see, the more we develop that sense of gratitude for the gifts and the giftedness of all things, the more, and the, right, the what follows from that, the reciprocity that comes, the more we see with new eyes and can go forth with clarity. And so I'm gonna end there. I have other quotes, but I know I've kind of gone a little long, so I'm gonna stop. I'm gonna stop there.
Next time.
I will just close by saying that my friends, we are living in a grave moment. Pause intentional. We are living in the grave that industrial society is digging for itself. We can still climb out if we look to the deep seeing and ways of knowing that reconnect us to the living world. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning.